From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, Hillary Clinton is home in New York recovering from pneumonia while her daughter and President Obama hit the campaign trail for her. When asked on CNN last night why her campaign didn't disclose her pneumonia before she appeared to faint on Sunday, she said she didn't think it was going to be a big deal. She was also asked how often she's had such bad dehydration.
Oh, I think really only twice that I can recall. You know, it is something that has occurred a few times over the course of my life, and you know, I'm aware of it and usually can avoid it.
There's the Clinton health question. Then there's reaction to her use of the word deplorable to describe half of Donald Trump's supporters. Some are now proudly calling themselves the deplorables. Democratic strategist Angela Rye has long been giving us the Democrats' perspective on campaign 2016. Angela, how bad is this moment?
You know, Robin, I have to tell you, I don't think this is a bad moment. I think that this is a good moment in American history because it gives us the opportunity to really address some of the concerns that many of us have talked about from the outset of this election season. When Donald Trump announced his campaign, the day he came down that escalator at Trump Tower and called Mexicans drug dealers and rapists, and he began to prey on white anger in this country and fear, I think, frankly, it is deplorable. And I kind of wish that Hillary Clinton hadn't walked back her statement. She said half, and based on what the data shows us, it actually is more than half.
Look, she did come out and say she shouldn't have said half of his supporters belong in the basket of deplorables. She was referring to the same people you're referring to,
That's right.
White supremacists, the websites and group leaders who support her. But it has opened the door for Donald Trump to attack her. Let's listen. Here he is speaking in Asheville, North Carolina yesterday.
She talks about people like they're objects, not human beings. She said half of our supporters are irredeemable and not American, and describes the other half as having run out of options.
Angela, how did this happen, that you have a candidate, Donald Trump, who himself has made comments about, you know, broad groups of Americans, Muslims, immigrants. Now he's able to accuse her of doing that.
Well, and here's the thing, Robin. You all just played a clip where he says that Hillary Clinton called them un-American. She never said that. So you here you have a presidential candidate who has a treacherous relationship with the truth, right?
Well, but she did call them deplorable.
But they're not un-American. 70% of his supporters who believe that Barack Obama, the first black president, is not American, that's deplorable. So we kind of have to call this what it is. That doesn't mean that Donald Trump can take her words and use brand new ones.
But, you know, even some of Hillary Clinton's supporters winced, and that's the word that's being used, when she said half of a candidate's supporters, you know, are deplorable. And as you know, there are a lot of whispers. Yesterday on NPR, Cokie Roberts said there were whispers of even replacing her. The combination of the misstep with the word deplorable, as some see it, and then the health issues. Go back to the health issues. Did she maybe not do herself a favor in her response to Anderson Cooper? Most people would say that a fainting spell is something that you really do remember. And she sounded as if, you know, well, it's happened only twice that I can recall. Should she have been stronger in talking about it?
I think that she has to be honest. We're talking about someone who has pneumonia and probably stubbornly didn't want to obey doctor's orders. How many of us have done that? To go to a 9/11 memorial, something that was deeply personal to her. We've seen the footage of Hillary Clinton being there at Ground Zero. And so why would she miss that? I can understand the choice that she made there. The other thing that I would say to you, Robin, is there was a woman who tweeted this yesterday, like Hillary Clinton did what every other woman does every single day, and she's being attacked for it. When you think about working mothers, when you think about folks who are working really hard jobs, sometimes one, two, or three jobs, this isn't something that's new to us.
But Angela, what about the honesty question? Why not? Why didn't the campaign just say on Friday, wow, our candidate's been diagnosed with pneumonia. Look at that.
Robin, I don't know. For the life of me, I don't understand that. And I definitely agree with you there. They should have said, listen, it's been a rough cycle. She's got pneumonia. This is terrible timing. But they didn't.
Well, is it possible because, you know, the other side, the Trump side, has been so successful in questioning her health? But should she be responding to that? In other words, did she play into their hands by not talking about her health, worried that they would make hay out of it?
a couple of things. One is, I think it was responsible of her not to engage in the rhetoric that's been out there about her having HIV, a tumor.
Parkinson's, I've heard.
I mean, all of it. Every single disease that she could have, they've given her. So I think that that actually was responsible. Just because Donald Trump has tried to mainstream Breitbart doesn't mean that she should. I do think, though, that the pneumonia issue flies in the face, not of necessarily what they've been saying about potential illnesses, but of transparency.
You mentioned Breitbart, the alt-right website, and now the head of that is Trump's campaign chairman. Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, taking a look at the Democratic side of the ledger. Angela, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the ceasefire in Syria is in its second day. The truce was brokered by the U.S. and Russia last week and is designed to at least temporarily stop the bloodshed after 5 years of civil war. More than 250,000 people have been killed and millions more displaced by the conflict. Joining us from Beirut is the BBC's James Longman. And James, what is the situation in Syria today? Have there been any reports of fighting?
Well, there have been reports of some violations, but by and large, this ceasefire is definitely holding. There have been no reports of any deaths, certainly. Residents of Aleppo and Idlib, two of the areas which underwent quite severe bombardments in recent weeks, have told us that it's been quiet by and large. I think Russia and the US would expect that there would be some violations, but they know very well that this is an imperfect truce. And what we're hearing at the moment is that Russian forces have gone in to secure the main road into Aleppo, so that the reason for this truce, the aid deliveries that need to get into Aleppo and other parts of Syria, can go ahead. And they are, we think, scheduled for tomorrow. So those 600,000 people who are in Syria waiting for that aid, hopefully will get it tomorrow if this truce continues to hold.
And what are the terms of the truce, and how long is it supposed to last?
So the terms are that Assad's planes are grounded for the first 48 hours, after which he is then given the green light to strike at those he terms terrorists across the country. But there are zones that the Americans and the Russians have delineated which he is not allowed to strike in. On their side, the rebels are told they are not allowed to put up arms against regime positions. After 48 hours, the situation is assessed, and every 48 hours for 7 days, the truce is analyzed. And then if after a week things look like they are as calm as they can be, then the US and the Russians begin their campaign to start bombing raids on the so-called Islamic State and Al-Qaeda affiliates inside Syria. That's quite some way away. I think everyone at the moment is waiting to see whether or not it can even last the first 24 hours, and that aid can get in from southern Turkey. We're told UN aid agencies and their partners are waiting on the border at the present to get that aid in.
But there's no possibility that this truce could turn into a permanent ceasefire.
Well, I think that would be the ideal, but I think everyone is very, very skeptical that that could happen, mostly because rebels still haven't totally agreed to the terms of this ceasefire. They say they understand the need to get humanitarian aid into the country, but as far as a political truce, that they don't envisage. They don't think that there have been enough sanctions on the government outlined in this plan should the government breach the terms of the truce. They don't think that they were given any kind of role in the negotiating process itself. And they're concerned that during the ceasefire itself, the government will then be able to perform land grabs, take huge parts of Syria, which at the moment are contested, they're under siege. They're worried that the government will take them over. So as far as they're concerned, they don't see this as a political way forward. They just see it as a way to get some aid in.
Well, let's listen to Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, who was in the city of Deraa yesterday. He was walking amid the rubble and said this. Here he is speaking through a BBC interpreter.
The Syrian state is determined to recover all areas from the terrorists, to restore security, to rebuild the infrastructure and everything else that was destroyed in both human and material aspects.
Is President Assad really committed to this ceasefire?
I think that he needs to show some willing, but politically and militarily, this is someone who has really never been stronger. we've seen this pattern before. In February, when the last time where John Kerry was able to broker some kind of truce with his partners, in the days that followed the agreement, in the days before the truce was actually implemented, the Syrian president came out and said he will reclaim all territory from the terrorists. And there was an upscale in violence in some of the hotspots. The exact same thing has happened this time. For the Syrian president, these sorts of truces, yes, they're important to get humanitarian aid in, but as far as he's concerned, political transition is about as far from his mind as it is possible to be. The opposition in Syria, the political opposition in Syria, isn't even really in Syria. It's in foreign cities. So he's on the front foot militarily, and for him that means a political solution, which sees him leaving power, I don't think, is on the cards at all. But we'll wait and see what the politicians have in store if this ceasefire does last for a week.
That's the BBC's James Longman speaking with us from Beirut, Lebanon. James, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Decades ago, there was flight from American cities to suburbs. Now people are moving back, and cities are trying to keep them without screwing up the very thing people come to cities for, character and community, and without leaving out or kicking out the longtime and often minority residents who've been there all along. Green Bay, Wisconsin renovated a rundown riverfront. Birmingham, Alabama rehabbed a 19-acre former rail yard, a rail front. Architects David Gamble and Patty Hato looked at the way 15 cities used new redevelopment. Their book is Rebuilding the American City, Design and Strategy for the 21st Century Urban Core, a must for city design wonks. Patty Hayda is in St. Louis, where she's a professor of urban design and architecture at Washington University. Patty, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And David Gamble is in our studios. His firm, Gamble Associates, is just across the river in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he's also a lecturer on urban planning and design at Harvard University. David, welcome to you as well.
Hi.
And Patty, start with you. What are the biggest challenges that cities are facing with this influx of, you know, mainly young people moving back in?
Well, I speak from the seat of being in St. Louis, and David and I had many conversations. One of the persistent challenges is maintaining social equity in the face of redevelopment. Clearly, there are poorer neighborhoods that often get displaced, but there are ongoing issues of climate change, aging infrastructure, among other things.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to hit on all of them when we talk about cities that have come up with solutions, because we're not talking about gentrifying. We're not just talking about prettying up neighborhoods with outdoor cafes and forcing the people who live there out. That's not the solution. You write that there are five different ways that cities are approaching this: anchor institutions, designing around an existing draw like a big hospital complex, maximizing a natural resource like the waterfront, a river, leveraging existing fabric, weaving kind of new threads of architecture into an existing fabric of a neighborhood, leveraging underutilized land. This is what they did in the Birmingham Railroad Park, and leveraging downtowns. An example is rehabbing Denver's Union Station. So you got those five examples. We're going to flesh them out. David, as you write, Boston and New York are thriving, but who knew about Buffalo? Talk about Buffalo and the idea of designing around an anchor institution.
That's right. Well, Buffalo is a great model because in 2001, there was a series of hospitals that really shared a territory but never really worked together to try to create that sense of place and that destination. And they understood that to compete, they would have to plan together and work in sync with the city. So in Buffalo, since 2001, the medical campus, which is really downtown, has doubled in its footprint. It's gone from really 3 million square feet to over 6 million square feet, and 7,000 employees to 17,000 employees just really in 12 years. I mean, that's a remarkable change.
Well, but talk about the design feature, Patty, because it's not just that it grew. Normally, when institutions like that grow, they just eat up a largely low-income area around them, or they moat themselves, you know, so they appear like a castle. What did they do with the land around the medical facilities in Buffalo that brought people in?
Well, they made a strategic decision in the planning of the project to allow for a new right-of-way through a linear park down the main avenue that connected these disparate institutions. So they essentially recruited design to create a unified identity
right,
for
but
the
people,
institutions.
People can enjoy the parklands around the hospitals, walking through it, and instead of feeling that they're barred from it. You mentioned, Patty, St. Louis, where you are, and this is the idea of leveraging existing fabric, weaving these new threads in. Don't just knock it all down. Talk about what used to be called McCree Town. Now it's been rebranded as Botanical Heights.
Essentially, this was an underserved neighborhood that was very near to an institutional anchor, which is the St. Louis Botanical Gardens. And the institution recognized that rather than walling off to their community, they can help that community regain its footing. However, the first phase of that redevelopment, I think the thinking at the time was that a radical approach was needed. This is in the early 2000s. And unfortunately, they wiped out 6 blocks of historic fabric. Mm. When it came time to implement the second phase of redevelopment, a local firm had moved into the neighborhood, and they became some involved in the redevelopment process. So the phase now that I'm talking about as being more effective, essentially, is much more incremental infill. And they're leveraging things like historic tax credits to be able to afford to preserve houses. They brought in a new Montessori school to really try to shore up possibilities for existing residents to have better school choice, to have a school choice. So there are not just bringing new buildings, but the manner in which they're bringing new buildings and the careful way that they're also bringing other elements to build the community back, I think, is remarkable in St. Louis.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Patty Haida and David Gamble. They're urban designers. Their new book is called Rebuilding the American City, and we'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. This is Here and Now. And David, what Patty was just talking about sounds great. It's sort of a bright, shiny penny in the middle of a city. It will attract people. But it also seems to start pushing longtime residents out.
That's right. And it's happening all over the country, this notion that as a place grows and gets better, particularly in downtown settings, there's increased pressure and, in fact, speculation on adjoining areas to somehow take advantage of that growth. And St. Louis is particularly pronounced because of its of the condition of the existing neighborhoods and the opportunities that are present for that. But you're witnessing that all across the country, a certain organic, almost entrepreneurial effort to rebuild in smaller areas, almost like pebbles where you throw in a stone and it might grow over time. And those pockets of energy actually are increasingly more effective than top-down, large-scale master plans that might take 20 or 30 years to come to fruition. So,
and that little stone is less likely to be the boulder that will push out existing residents.
Exactly.
Well, maybe upgrading their neighborhoods. Well, I mean, again, you go into much more depth on all of this in the book, but I want to take a look at natural resources. This has been so popular on the East Coast. Talk about Chattanooga, Tennessee, Patty. What did they do?
In Chattanooga, they decided to redevelop their riverfront, and they created over 129 acres of new development and park on their river. When we talk about riverfronts or districts and new development, there's always a much more protracted time frame that these things take years to build and play out and multiple administrations. In Chattanooga, it's unique because the mayor essentially started, implemented, and completed this major project to redevelop their riverfront in 35 months during his administration.
And I think that leadership is one of those themes that comes through in all of these 15 cities. But let me tell you about partnerships. And what was so unique about the Chattanooga case also was that the three primary cultural institutions decided to share their donor lists, and all of the money that went into the fundraising went to this particular project. Mm-hmm. And they were able to raise 50% of that, $120 million, in 3 months.
Yeah, well, that's another way it's going to go quicker than just doing it with public money,
yeah,
like private money involved. I love the projects that have been using, I mean, that's riverfront, but I love railfront and underutilized land. There's an old rail connector that was turned into a bikeway in Atlanta. In Birmingham, the railroad park that once, you know, was this abandoned rail yard is now what, Patty?
In Birmingham, this was a manufacturing city, of course, built on the rails and the steel industry there. And when the manufacturing moved out, just like so many American cities, they were left with literally a divided downtown. And their strategy was to embrace this. And the landscape essentially brings you right up close to watch the trains. It's a celebration of the industrial heritage.
Yeah, they kept a lot of you have to kind of keep some of the old when you build the new, David.
That's right. In fact, the edginess and the grittiness of that viewing platform that they've created in this 19-acre park is really what creates the allure to get people downtown and to make it a regional destination.
And we've been talking about cities, David, but the latest census data shows the suburbs are now, again, outpacing city growth. What do you see the next tier of thinking being about revitalizing suburbs?
That's a great point. And as more and more people move downtown, not just millennials, but people of all generations, it places a particular burden on those places that they just left. And
that they lose tax income.
Income and the character of all of that architecture and development that has occurred. And Atlanta was the poster child for sprawl for decades. And look at what's happening in the downtown core now. So I think that the next big challenge actually will be finding ways primarily through investment in transportation and transit, public transit, to make these places more accessible, easier to link to other job centers and networks of employment so that they don't atrophy in the way in which our downtown cores did.
You mean the suburbs?
Yeah.
So more public transportation too than David Gamble of the architecture firm Gamble Associates, Patty Haida of Washington University. David, Patty, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And again, we have great pictures at hereandnow.org, but also send us yours. Maybe it's a bike path on an old train track or an art incubator in an old factory. What is your town doing? The smaller projects even that might keep people there and also keep the character. Let us know at hereandnow.org. A heartbreaking story in Memphis, the worst loss of life in a fire there in almost a century. 9 people, including 6 siblings, died in a house fire caused by an air conditioner cord. A 7th child is hospitalized. Their mom had reportedly ironed and laid out all their school clothes the night before. Now, the home had a working fire alarm, but it also had security bars on windows and doors. And while it's not clear if that hampered escape, neighbors were heard saying they didn't know how they'd get out of their own barred windows. So let's get a reminder. Judy Camaletti is with the National Fire Protection Association. Judy, your thoughts.
Oh, well, first of all, our hearts go out to the people of Memphis, the families involved, the firefighters. This is a real tragedy, and it's a reminder that we need to be careful and know how we're going to escape our home in case of a fire. So there are several things that we need to do.
Well, start with the security bars. Hey, they are on windows and doors. Tell us about them.
Well, with security bars, and many people have them if they live in high crime areas and they want to feel safe, and that is fine, but you need to make sure that your security bars are equipped with what we call a quick release device. And the NFPA Life Safety Code states that all ways out of a room must be opened easily from inside.
But we know that many of these homes in some of these poorer neighborhoods are older, and those bars were put on years ago and they're permanently attached.
Correct. And that's where we really need to get people to start thinking about replacing at least one of those bars in a bedroom or any room with a quick release device. And a quick release device, you can actually use a lever or push a button to open up that security bar so that you can use that window as an exit.
And again, we don't know if this was the cause in Memphis, but we do know that firemen are trained to get those bars off from the outside. And in fact, they broke down the security door in this house to get in. Judy, you mentioned, so replace them or make your landlord replace them. But these are expensive, like $200 for a set.
Correct. That's about the price of the security bars. So I would work with if these are rental properties, I would work with a landlord. You can also reach out if you're not getting any results from the landlord. I would reach out to the fire department who could actually help get this job done.
Can they
be
cited? Can they be cited if you have security bars that are fast and secure and permanently attached?
Well, it's going to depend. Laws are different in different areas, mm-hmm. different communities or states. So it's going to depend on what the fire officials and the building officials allow in the community. So that's what people need to do if they are in rental properties. You know, but this would be a great project for a community to really wrap their hands around raising funds to help people living in homes with these permanent security bars to at least get some of those bars to be quick release so that they are able to get out in case of a fire.
You plant the seed of a great idea. Judy Camaletti of the National Fire Protection Association talking about replacing permanently attached security bars with those with quick release after bars might have, we're not sure, but might have prevented 9 people from escaping a house in Memphis. Judy, thank you.
You're very welcome. And make sure everyone has smoke alarms and test them. Make sure they're working and have your escape plan ready to go.
Well, let's get to the Here and Now DJ sessions, and this week with some Afropop. Georges Coulinet is host of Afropop Worldwide. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Georges, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy.
And tell us, first of all, what Afropop is exactly. What is the genre?
Afropop is presenting African music, the African and the African diaspora music and culture. So we go, let's say, we go to Africa, and then we see a new people that are having new releases, that are presenting their new releases, and they are talking about what influenced their music and how it was influenced. And usually they say, well, you know, you have to come to the village because that's where it's happening. Afropop is just storytelling. I call it storytelling.
Storytelling. And let's get to some of it. And this is Kesewa by the Ghanaian artist Osei Koronkie. Kasewa, nimoni mukasewa miende niyo, nimoni mukasewa miende niyo. A beautiful sound there. And tell us what instrument is that?
The instrument is called a seperewa. And it sounds almost like a kora. Or if you want, a ngoni. Ngoni is that instrument that are played by the hunters in Mali. And the style of music is called palm wine. I love that. Hmm. And to listen to this and in the evening, you know, under the palm tree and drinking your palm wine and talking trash with the rest of the village is,
Well, and tell us more about Osei Koronkie.
Osei Koronkie is a gentleman that's a teacher. I mean, he's a teacher in Ghana, at the University of Ghana in Legon. And he has inspired a lot of people to reuse this instrument called the seperewa, and it's quite amazing. The man is regal, and there's a lot of royalty in Ghana. In that region, the chiefs and the kings are covered with their kente cloth, and they have jewels, gold all over they're brimming with gold. It's amazing, and I love it because, you know, there's always something very nostalgic there. I don't know if it's because they have moved from the north of Africa down to the coast or whatever. But I love it. It's just something that is strangely haunting in that music. And Osei is pushing, he's trying to revive that palm wine high life music. Because for a while, you know, rock and roll, rap and everything else, and even Latin American music had taken over the music of the country. So that's what he's doing. And it's doing it very successfully.
Well, and the next one that you brought us is also from that same part of West Africa, from the Ivory Coast in this case. This is the artist Soumbil, and this is called Bledji. It reminds me of the fact that some music that comes out of West Africa really does sound similar, and I guess it makes total sense, to some of the music that comes out of the Caribbean.
Absolutely, absolutely, because all these people went there.
I mean,
once, I always remember, I went in Ecuador, and there was a priest that came during a ceremony that they had, the local ceremony there. And the priest was from Benin, and he was flabbergasted. He said, "My goodness, I understand everything they say." Hmm. All the way to Ecuador on the other side of the Americas. And that was amazing. And this guy, Sumbil, is very, very good at his art, and he's very, very popular. The last time I saw him, it was, about two months ago, at the MASA, which is this big, huge music conference in Abidjan. And he had this souped-up Mercedes that is, you know, two-seater, beautiful machine. Never seen one of that, one like that. And I was saying, well, maybe I should have done that instead of going on radio.
Yeah, public radio just doesn't pay the same way, does it? No.
Absolutely not. Ay, ay, ay. Well, but anyway, it's more fun.
Well, the next one that you brought us is from Cameroon. This is Ekambi Brilliant with Donde Vas.
Ay, tu te vas, quieres marcharte. Y yo no sé por qué te vas. ¿Qué nos pasó? ¿Qué ha cambiado? Estábamos también juntos.
Georges, you are reminding us how completely culturally diverse Africa really is, because this is now a Latin influence.
Exactly. You know, it's Latin American music is, it's very strange. It goes around and around. It crosses the ocean from Africa, you know, music from, let's say, the rumba by the Zaire people, I mean, or Congolese people, and it goes to the Americas, and then it comes back because the Africans are saying, "Oh wow, you know, that's a great sound," etc., etc. And so, Ekambi Brilliant is an old timer. He's been on the music scene of Cameroon forever, and boy, that guy is so successful, so much so that he came here last month, went to New York in a studio, hired a whole bunch of top Latin musicians and Cameroonian musicians, and put that thing together. Hmm. And you know, it's a new. It's not released even yet.
Wow,
it's a premiere.
Well, we have time for one more, and this is also from Cameroon.
And
it's also a premiere.
Yes.
This is Diaspora. This is by Henri Dikongé.
Sur les chemins de poussière. Tu n'as laissé qu'un pas d'errant. Et dans mon cœur et dans mon âme, ton souvenir me sert d'amant. De mon corps au sein si lourd, tu as oublié la chaleur. Et dans un coin de ta mémoire, tu gardes en toi mon goût sucré.
So what's this one about?
This one is about refugees leaving Africa to go to Europe. And the words are just amazing. I am the land, I am Africa, the river, the forest. But in your father's village, your name is slowly disappearing. Hmm. I am the wisdom of an ancestor without a future. You think that wealth is over there, so I had to let you go.
Wow.
Man, I was crying when he sent me that record, you know, because it's just... And his wife, who's reading this thing here, Laurence, is just, I don't know, she has that voice, you know, very, very simple, very, very touching.
And what is Henri Dikongé's connection to refugees?
Well, he's very concerned about it because, you know, as you know, in France, we have a lot of refugees and we have these camps. But these are the Syrians primarily, and they are better off in a way. But the African refugees, oh my God, it's just unbelievable, unbelievable. They put them in jail. The discrimination is terrible also. And that's maybe why.
Well, an important topic there to close this out, and some great music from all over Africa. Georges Coulinet, host of Afropop Worldwide, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. See you on the radio.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. We're NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
A major transformation is underway in how energy is produced, delivered, and consumed in the U.S. We've been checking in, so let's do that now in Maine, where a pilot project is disrupting utilities' traditional business models. A startup company in the town of Boothbay Harbor avoided the need to build a costly new transmission line by saving and even making electricity right in the neighborhood. Fred Bever of Maine Public Radio reports.
In winter, Boothbay Harbor is practically a ghost town, with about 2,000 residents hunkering down at the tip of a peninsula that fingers out from the mid-coast. But in warm weather, the region booms with tens of thousands of summer residents and vacationers. A first stop for many is TND Variety, where you can gas up, enjoy a hot breakfast, and on a hot day, cool off inside. But instead of a traditional energy-hogging air conditioning unit, co-owner Deb Frankel says you can thank the ice machines, or ice bears, as they're called.
You have two units with tanks that build ice, and when the ice builds, it cools the water, and then you have cold air coming in.
It's a pretty simple energy storage system. At night, two compressors out back freeze up 4 tons of ice. And then in the day, fans blow air across the blocks, and the cooled air flows in, reducing the need to blast the air conditioners.
And I think there's a lot of success locally with I think a lot of people are pleased with it, and I love the concept.
There are 31 ice bears dotting the Boothbay region now, just one element of a multi-technology effort to manage the peninsula's surge of electricity demand that comes on the hottest summer evenings. The community-wide initiative came in response to a proposal by the local utility, Central Maine Power, to build a new transmission line at an upfront cost of $18 million and long-term costs of tens of millions more, just to serve that very occasional peak load. But a company called Grid Solar had a different idea.
It's far cheaper to provide power where you use it than to make power 100 miles away and build a 100-mile transmission line at millions of dollars a mile to deliver that power.
Steve Hinchman is a principal at Grid Solar. The company argued that instead of building costly transmission lines, it could marshal an array of local energy resources to cut down electricity demand at a much lower cost to ratepayers. The regulators bought it as a pilot project. So the ice bears went in. Solar panels were installed en masse on the YMCA roof, the firehouse roof. Businesses screwed in hundreds of energy-saving compact fluorescent bulbs. A grid-scale diesel generator and three powerful truck-sized batteries were placed near a utility substation.
It's an entirely different way of looking at introducing competition into the market.
Energy consultant William Petland says utilities have a big incentive to build new transmission lines. When regulators agree that an upgrade is needed for grid reliability, the utilities can earn a federally mandated profit of around 11% and charge it to ratepayers. Projects like Grid Solar's, Pentland says, can provide a new, disruptive option
that has serious financial implications for how a utility operates. That's the key. There's no question that their investment agenda will be affected.
It's disruptive, but to the extent that we see it as a threat, that's not productive.
Central Maine Power spokesman John Carroll says the utility can learn from the Grid Solar project, particularly about its new smart grid data technology, which can detail local electric conditions moment by moment. And momentum is building. With regulators now considering bigger non-transmission alternatives elsewhere in Maine and around the nation. In Brooklyn, Con Edison is getting ahead of the competitive curve, proposing a grand variation of the grid solar multi-tech system it says will defer the need for a $1.2 billion transmission upgrade at one-fifth the cost. Central Maine Power's John Carroll says as these alternatives make a bigger mark on the grid, utilities will have to take a leadership position.
Still have the same obligations to our customers to make sure the system is reliable. We still have, you know, we have a shared interest with our customers, you know, in meeting their needs for lower cost service.
As it turned out, the Booth Bay region isn't coming close to the peak loads the utility first predicted. So the cheaper grid solar pilot project wasn't necessary, and it will end after this summer. But simply because it was on the regulator's table, that new transmission line wasn't built. The state's consumer watchdog says that alone has saved more money than any other recent effort to reduce transmission costs in Maine. For Here and Now, I'm Fred Bever.
And Fred's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. And staying with energy alternatives, a reminder, the first offshore wind farm in the U.S. will begin generating electricity next month. The Block Island Wind Farm is off the coast of Rhode Island and Block Island. The five turbines will power about 17,000 homes. Offshore wind farms are more common in Europe, but U.S. residents have had concerns about environmental impact and blocking ocean views. Well, on Block Island, we saw the turbines this summer. They are visible, but way back up on the horizon. We'll be watching when they fire up. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.